So let's set up our broadcasting of this. So it's something for you people to listen to if you're interested. If you're going to go away, we'll see you in the morning. Great talking to Jacob. It's always great to have a new person who has a good phone and hearing what's going on. And it was good that Colin got to say his situation, which validates all of us. So let's see. Unmute all.
All participants are now muted.
So then that, and that's Bert. Okay.
Yes.
That's me.
Right. Yes. That's you, and that's Bert.
Yes, as I have been talking about many aspects of...
Without the
many
eye,
aspects
you can't
that
tell.
Were never considered about...
About what?
I thought I was muted. Yes, about many things that were never considered and could not even be understood because they were not known about how America came to be and how things really work, the bloodlines, and how all these houses reflect in many things in society until now. And I think it's important just to hear what Zappa says and then to overlay on that.
Yes.
So that it makes
right.
sense.
Right. There was a thought ahead. You were... I don't know what it was. Where was it? What was that? So we're listening... you know, we're up to 131 hours, or 130. That's how much we've done so far, 130 hours on Zappa. 130. And let's see.
It's actually median ecology.
Right. We could do a lot more. We're controlling our output. Okay, so I've got the sound up. Okay, so the Zappa Hour is officially starting. Hey, Bert, I'm going to mute you and Roxanna so no sounds overlay the video. So.
Okay, well.
Everybody's muted. And later we'll be playing a lot of good stuff that I got from Ian this week, but that'll be many hours down there. Okay, so here we go. I think I've got the volume properly up. So we're beginning the Zappa Hour.
Your nomination for president.
I accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Today, all U.S. citizens 18 or older have the constitutional right to register and vote for the candidate of their choice in national, state, and local elections. But this hasn't always been the case. Historically, people have created all sorts of roadblocks and reasons for why some of us shouldn't be allowed to vote. Reasons like...
You're a woman.
You're an immigrant. You have to live here 21 years before you can register.
You're a Negro.
You're an Indian.
If you can't recite the Constitution perfectly, then you can't register.
After the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, each of the new states wrote constitutions in which they limited the right to vote to white males who owned property. In a few cases, religion might be a condition for voting. But the real emphasis was on wealth and the ownership of property.
In South Carolina, for example, you need $10,000 in currency to be governor, $2,000 to be senator. To be elected to the House of Representatives, you must believe in God and the existence of heaven and hell. But the idea of property-based voting is hotly debated.
The right of voting for a representative is the primary right by which others are protected. To take away this right is to reduce a man to a state of slavery. For slavery consists in being subject to the will of another. And he that does not have a right to vote in the election of a representative is a slave.
Depend on it, sir. It is dangerous to open so fruitful a source of controversy and altercation as would be opened by attempting to alter the qualifications of voting. There will be no end to it. Women will demand a vote. Lads from 12 to 21 will think their rights not enough attended to. And every man who has not a farthing will demand an equal voice with any other in all acts of state.
But in the early years of the country, property-based suffrage does allow some blacks and women to vote, though this right is later taken away.
The belief was at the founding of the Republic that people should vote who had a stake in society, and that stake was generally measured in terms of property. The qualification was not a racial one, but it was an economic one.
At the Constitutional Convention of 1787, Morris of Pennsylvania argues in favor of tying the right to vote to land ownership. Oliver Ellsworth of Connecticut disagrees.
Ought not every man who pays a tax vote for the representative who is to levy and dispose of his money?
Give the votes to people who have no property, and they will sell them to the rich who will be able to buy them.
The convention ultimately decides to let each state write its own guidelines for voting, and these guidelines vary widely from state to state. Vermont has full manhood suffrage, and its only requirements for voting are a year's residence and quiet and peaceable behavior. Kentucky's constitution specifically excludes Negroes, mulattoes, and Indians. Connecticut's guidelines for voting include owning property, a higher age requirement, and a good moral conduct qualification, which essentially means you have to belong to the established church. From 1790 to the beginning of the Civil War in 1860, rules for voting rights gradually become more restrictive for all but white males.
Racism and democracy seem to advance hand in hand in the early republic. And during the first three decades of the 19th century, as suffrage, as property qualifications began to fall more generally, and as states instituted universal suffrage, they also inserted the word white in that. So you had adult male white suffrage, and those blacks who could vote under the old property-holding standard lost their vote.
Apart from a few Midwestern states hungry for settlers, most states restrict voting rights for immigrants. In the West, Asians are excluded, and immigrants in the Northeast, mostly Irish Catholics, are forced to pass lengthy residency tests for voting and office holding.
In the years leading up to the Civil War, abolitionists and suffragists worked together to abolish slavery in the South. In 1848, a year of revolution in Europe and Mexico, and the year the Communist Manifesto was signed, 300 people gather in a church in Seneca Falls, New York, to discuss the status of women. The most revolutionary item on the agenda is voting.
In that year, a woman named Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her mentor, a woman named Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker and an anti-slavery activist, organized a small meeting in Seneca Falls, New York. Then this convention was different than others in that it concentrated entirely on women's rights. And the most controversial demand was the demand for the right to vote, which most of the rather radical attendees were wary of signing on to.
Elizabeth Stanton's controversial resolution read, "Resolve that it is the duty of the women of this country to secure to themselves their sacred right to the elective franchise." The convention and Stanton's resolution are dismissed by the public and widely ridiculed in the press. But the first shots are fired in a battle that would last another 72 years before women win the right to vote. With the the Civil War over, the country's attention focuses on bringing American blacks into mainstream life. At this time, blacks cannot vote in the South or in most of the North. Ironically, only six northern states at this time permit blacks to vote.
In the years following the Civil War, Congress approved several major pieces of legislation designed to protect the civil rights of blacks and to sweep from power those Southerners who fought with the Confederacy and supported slavery. Republicans who control Congress hope that giving blacks the vote will attract them to the Republican Party and assure their majority in Congress. The ballot is also seen as a weapon to protect blacks against violence and intimidation.
In January of 1866, Congress passes a civil rights bill which, for the first time, defines citizenship and prohibits discrimination based on race. President Andrew Johnson vetoes the bill.
Federal protection of black civil rights and the broad conception of national power behind it constitutes a stride towards centralization and the concentration of all legislative power in the national government. The distinction of race and color is by the bill made to operate in favor of the colored and against the white race.
Congress overrides the president's veto and enacts the civil rights bill into law. Former slaves quickly take advantage of their newly gained rights.
As word filters down about what the Congress has done as far as the new Reconstruction Act, they've organized meetings, they're petitioning, they're having conventions, they're choosing leaders.
Violence against blacks in the South continues. Race riots in Memphis and New Orleans leave blacks dead in the streets. The radical Republican Congress responds by passing the 14th Amendment to the Constitution to further strengthen Negro rights. The amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside.
Once they do get the vote, they vote in incredible numbers. In short, the suffrage is viewed as something extraordinarily important. It's a means to many ends for black people. They identified it as part and parcel of freedom, and they take advantage of it as soon as they can.
The Congress goes even further. It begins to work on the 15th Amendment that says a citizen's right to vote cannot be abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. This radical new amendment is met with resistance in the South as well as opposition from some northern conservatives.
I do not believe that the Negro race and white race can mingle in the exercise of political power and bring good results to society. We are different. The difference is morally and intellectually, and I do not believe that we can mingle successfully in the management of government.
Sir, it is impossible in the very nature of things that such a large portion of citizens of the United States as the black portion now are can for any considerable length of time remain in our midst without enjoying the right of suffrage.
As soon as blacks can vote, they run for office and are successful in being elected. This lithograph shows members of the 41st and 42nd Congress. South Carolina's first post-Civil War state legislature has a black majority. B.S. Pinchback of Louisiana becomes the first black governor in American history, and Jonathan J. Wright is placed on the Louisiana State Supreme Court. But the period in which blacks can vote with relative security is short. Ku Klux Klan violence escalates. Lynchings and other forms of intimidation are used to discourage blacks from voting.
By 1876, both the North and the South are tired of the quarreling and violence that has accompanied the Reconstruction of the South. So the Republicans and Democrats strike a compromise. Republicans maintain control of the White House, and in return, Southern Democrats are assured that federal forces will be withdrawn from the South.
But the Negro is the victim of this historic compromise. Without federal protection, blacks become second-class citizens. And by the 1890s, this short experiment in social and political equality comes to an end. For the next 80 years, lynchings, literacy tests, understanding clauses, and other roadblocks suppress black voting. But what about women?
Yeah.
How did black men get the vote and not women?
The Republican Party that was in control of the government could see that the black men in the South would vote Republican and would help control the ex-Confederates, but women around the country white women in particular, had no such partisan advantage. So they allowed themselves, Republican leaders allowed themselves to be sort of pushed into the position of supporting black suffrage, but they would not in any way support women's suffrage. And women suffragists who had started out with both of these goals of the abolition of slavery and the enfranchisement of freed men and women and the enfranchisement of white women found themselves having to, in the horrible position of having to choose between these two goals.
What is Susan B. Anthony's response to waiting for suffrage until black men are enfranchised?
I will cut off this right arm before I will ever work for or demand the ballot for the Negro and not the woman.
Much to the horror of Anthony and other suffragists, the 14th Amendment inserts the word male into the Constitution for the first time. The second clause protects the rights of any of the male inhabitants of such state.
But Anthony and other suffragists decide on a broader interpretation of the 14th and 15th Amendments. They decide that because the 14th Amendment defines any persons born or naturalized in the U.S. as citizens, that they are citizens and therefore constitutionally entitled to the right to vote.
So she voted, and she was completely thrilled. She wrote a letter to Elizabeth Stanton and said, I've done it, I've gone and voted, it feels great, you should go do it. And she was elated. And two or three weeks later, there's a knock on the door. It's a U.S. federal marshal who announces that she's in violation of federal legislation that had been passed to control and prohibit the votes of Confederates, that is to say, traitors.
Marianne Chad Carey is a good example of that in Washington, D.C. The interesting thing is Carey was able to register. They allowed her to register to vote, but when she went to vote, they wouldn't take her ballot.
From the early 70s on, you can repeatedly find examples of women, and I've discovered not only in this country but around the world, who engage in this, what you'd have to call direct action voting. So this was a very elegant and constitutionally well-informed form of civil disobedience.
The suffrage movement is made up of a wide variety of remarkable women. Paulina Davis publishes one of the first periodicals devoted to the women's rights movement. Mary Livermore averages 150 lectures annually on women's suffrage for 23 years. Belva Ann Lockwood is nominated for President of the United States in 1884 by the National Equal Rights Party. Get down, Belva. Abigail Scott Duniway leads the suffrage struggle in the Pacific Northwest and is the first Oregon woman to register to vote.
Ida B. Wells from Chicago is one of my favorite people, period. Okay, and one of the reasons that I admired her suffrage activities is that she had young children, a young baby at the time, and she would pack that baby up and go to political meetings, and the women would be notified ahead of time, and they'd find a babysitter to watch her baby while she would go and talk to the women and encourage them to vote. And I think that that's very significant for the early 20th century, where getting around with a young child was a lot more difficult than it is today.
The suffragists travel from state to state to persuade male legislators to give women the vote. They lobby Teddy Roosevelt at his Sagamore Hill home. Harriet Stanton Blatch appears on Wall Street and presents her case to hundreds. Alice Paul and her supporters picket the U.S. Capitol and the White House. They also burn the words of President Woodrow Wilson, who doesn't support them until 1919.
20 million women are denied the right to vote, and you, President Wilson, are the chief opponent of their enfranchisement.
They are arrested and jailed in large numbers. But the most successful form of public demonstrations is the suffrage parades that take place in New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and other cities. At first, women ride in cars because walking alone might give the appearance they are streetwalkers or women of low moral standards. By 1912, thousands march in New York City. Many wear white and carry bright colored banners identifying their hometowns and sometimes their professions. In 1912, the New York Times reports that 10,000 men and women march for suffrage. They also run an editorial arguing against votes for women. The movement must be quelled, if it is to be quelled at all, by the men. They must make it plain to women that they intend to retain possession of the government. For the next 7 years, women work hard for a constitutional amendment. In 1920, the 19th Amendment of the Constitution is ratified. Denial of the right to vote in any election on the grounds of sex is prohibited.
so blacks get the vote.
And women get the vote.
What about Native Americans?
Good question. In 1924, an act of Congress makes U.S. citizens of all Native Americans. But they're not allowed to vote in New Mexico and Arizona because of a provision which does not require Indians to pay taxes on trust status lands. In 1947, Miguel Trujillo, a Native American ex-Marine sergeant and schoolteacher, tries to register to vote in New Mexico. He is refused because he is
an Indian.
Trujillo sues the state, and a panel of federal judges decides that since Indians do pay most other taxes, New Mexico's rules amount to taxation without representation. After 36 years of statehood, New Mexico is forced to grant its Native American citizens the right to vote in state and local elections.
In the 1950s, most U.S. citizens over 21 have the constitutional right to vote, but many of the southern states have such restrictive rules to register that blacks are in reality disenfranchised. In response, the Eisenhower administration begins work on the Civil Rights Act of 1957. In the spring of 1957, a young Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. speaks at a civil rights rally in Washington, D.C. "Give us the ballot," he says, "and we would transform the misdeeds of bloodthirsty mobs into the calculated good deeds of ordinary citizens. Give us the ballot, and we would fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill. Give us the ballot, and we will place judges on the benches of the South who will do justly and love mercy."
So when the Eisenhower administration came in, President Eisenhower pledged himself to remove discrimination in all based on color in all areas where the federal government was responsible. And of course, the most important one was the question of voting rights. There had been attempts made all through the years to remedy the situation and allow blacks to vote without fear. But they were always killed off in the Congress by a filibuster in the Senate. They have the unlimited voting, unlimited speaking rule there, so they would just talk it to death.
Civil rights supporters prevail, and Congress passes the first Civil Rights Act since Reconstruction, giving increased federal protection to black voters. But it isn't enough. Black demands for equal treatment multiply, and violence against blacks escalates. Blacks are arrested for demonstrating, and police use fire hoses and police dogs to break up marches. In 1963, thousands marched to the nation's capital demanding equal rights. The tension comes to a head in Selma, Alabama on Sunday, March 7, 1965. John Lewis, now a U.S. congressman, helps lead nearly 600 people on a march to highlight their demands to register and vote. They march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and into a line of Alabama state troopers.
But they came toward us in a rush, great rush, tramping us, beating us with nightsticks and bullwhip, and tramping us with horses. And then they released the tear gas. Several of us were hurt. To this day, I don't know how I made it back across the bridge, across the Alabama River, through downtown Selma, back to Brown Chapel Emmy Church. But I do recall being back at the church, and someone asked me, did I want to say something? And I stood up and said something to the effect, I don't understand how President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam and cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote.
A week later, President Lyndon Johnson, a Southern Democrat, sends a voting rights bill to Congress. He delivers a speech to a joint session of Congress that is broadcast on national television.
Many of the issues of civil rights are very complex and most difficult. But about this, there can and should be no argument. Every American citizen must have an equal right to vote.
Congress passes the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which abolishes literacy tests as a requirement for voting and enforces rights previously denied by local officials. Black civil rights leaders, once beaten and jailed in the South, now join President Johnson as he signs these protections into law. The 60s in the United States is a time of rapid change. The Beatles revolutionize music and take America by storm.
Mini skirts.
Hippies. Hendrix. Hank Ashbury.
And body paint are all in. The decade begins with the election of the youngest president in history.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans.
The election of John Kennedy creates a new activism and a renewed sense of interest in politics among young people. The nonviolent activism of Martin Luther King Jr. attracts them to marches and voter registration drives in the South. The 1968 presidential campaigns of Robert Kennedy, Eugene McCarthy, and Richard Nixon bring thousands of college students into presidential politics. But nothing fans the flames of activism more than Vietnam. 18-year-old men are being drafted to fight in Southeast Asia. America is divided. The evening news is filled with pictures of students marching, seizing school buildings, being arrested, and tear gassed.
I think one of the things that produced that movement that created the 18-year-old voting right was the war in Vietnam. We had hundreds of thousands of young people fighting in Vietnam. At one point, our armies over there were in excess of 500,000 people. And I heard the argument frequently made that if young people are old enough to fight and die for their country, they're old enough to vote.
Congress introduces legislation to lower the voting age to 18. Former U.S. Senator Birch Bayh chaired the Senate subcommittee that drafted legislation lowering the voting age.
There are other reasons. I mean, when someone is 18 in this day and age, they begin to accept the responsibilities of citizenship. Many people have full-time jobs when they reach age 18. They're paying taxes. They begin to raise families. And they begin to be affected more directly and personally by what their government does. All the more reason for them to have a right to vote.
Lowering the voting age for federal elections in 1970 adds roughly 11 million eligible voters between the ages of 18 and 21. President Nixon signs the measure into law, but does not feel Congress has the constitutional authority to lower the voting age on its own. The Supreme Court agrees with the president, and Justice Hugo Black, in a majority opinion, writes that Congress can regulate the voting age in a national but not state elections.
Within 6 months, Congress passes and three-fourths of the states ratify the 26th Amendment, forbidding the denial of the right to vote of any citizen on account of age, if such citizen is 18 years or older.
Two centuries of legal and individual struggle has brought universal suffrage to all Americans over 18. But today, one massive obstacle remains, and that is apathy. George McGovern was the Democratic candidate for president in 1972, the first year that 18-year-olds across the nation could vote in a presidential election.
One of the big disappointments to me in 1972 was the small percentage of eligible first-time voters who actually voted. Even on college campuses, I was amazed to find that on some of the better campuses in this country, 10, 11, 12% of those eligible to vote actually participated in that election.
The percentage of all eligible voters 18 to 24 years old who voted in 1980 was 33%, 34% in 1984, and 29% in 1988. This same downward trend continues today.
I tell young people to believe in something. To have a dream, to have a vision of the future, to lose themselves in something that is much larger, much bigger than they are. Forget about their own circumstances and get involved in the circumstances of others.
They should recognize that they still have their lives ahead of them, so issues like the environment are of more importance to them than they are to older people who may not be around for decades to come, and they should vote.
It's your vote, and only you can use it. Each election brings you the chance to help change the world around you. In the past, ballots have been cast to set the driving age, the minimum wage, federal funding for your high school or college. Even the quality standards for the water you drink and the air you breathe is determined by the people you vote into office. Your vote counts.
It's your right and...
I don't know if that was the end. I
hit the FB in Berkeley.
I clicked something and it let me bring this in here. Is that? That? What else? This? That?
Hello.
Okay, Bert.
Hello. Yeah, but the most important things were already said.
Yeah, like it was there winding down, and I went to click something, and it went off. So I don't know if it ended by me or it was ending anyways, but it was ending.
Well,
so
but
we didn't. I was wondering about.
Yeah, it was ending.
Yes.
Yes. The happy ending.
Yes. The thing is, when Frank Zappa wanted to be president, he realized there is a lot of weird things going on. I suppose people who go into that type of competition had to be somehow initiated because of the things that are really going on and that Ion has been explaining since he came forth. And
yes.
I was reading a professor from La Sorbonne. His name is Lucien Belli, and he's a diplomat and a historian, and he wrote a book about the history of foreign relationships, and he saw how all this diplomacy come from the relationships between the houses and the princes. So in order to understand these weird situations, he went to study what he calls the society of the princes and the life of a king from birth to his funeral. And he saw that the idea of the divine blood, the idea that God says who has the right to rule is given to an elite according to their blood. And this was universally accepted all over the world. It was not only in Europe. So he thought it was very interesting, and he went to study really in depth all these special society and the beliefs that surround the divine blood. And he saw that the divine blood actually mirrored everywhere in the society, in all the laws, how things are structured, how a person is treated, the etiquette, the way somebody would talk to anybody, what he could do, who he could marry. And all the aspects of society were actually defined by the amount of divine blood one person had. And this is very interesting because, in a way, it's an explanation of why Ion talks a lot about the houses and all this story about the castles, and then Louisiana and America. And Zappa knew that America is a special place, and from the foundation, there was this belief that there is like a providential destiny, a special mission in this land. And there was a long fight to see who has the power from all these houses in this new territory. And that was going on already with Frank and the Habsburgs and Spain. And this professor Lucien Belli says the First World War was actually the defining of who is going to control the new territories. And France had to sell Louisiana and what they call La Nouvelle France. They gave that territory to England and Spain. But the things that are behind all that, for real, because many things the historians don't understand, are explained by Ion and the woo-woo and the mystery landscape he was already talking about at the beginning. And many things that seem to be disconnected are now making sense, and everything is connecting. But until now, nobody could explain the totality of what is going on, because they were not considering the woo-woo and the non-physical and only Bob with his median ecology, like Ion calls it, could go and explain the situation. So that's my introduction.
That's very good.
Do
you're very
you have
articulate
anything
as usual.
To say?
Yes, can you hear me? I'm audible, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yes.
Wait a minute. I'm audible. And you guys, you're audible. Okay, as usual, Roxy, you're very articulate. I like the way you organize your thoughts, lay it out step by step. Sounds like you wrote it out. Do you write it out, or do you have notes? Or is it just natural?
No, I read a lot, and then these things sort of make sense, and I just talk about all these things. I usually forget a lot. But
wow. Right, but you, the basic step-by-step equations, the step-by-step equations is the logic
yeah, for example, Luciana
that requires.
Says that the food of the king was very important, and from the beginning, for example, they choose very well who was going to give the milk to the prince, and they control
right.
the environment very carefully. This person had to be very calm, with no strong emotions, very boring life, and
yeah.
They control the food of the person and. Because they knew that the milk and the blood are essential, and they wanted to preserve this divine blood that they claim comes from Egypt, and some lines go back to King David, and that's why there was all this inbreeding, and in Egypt the pharaohs will even marry their daughters. Or the brothers, their sisters,
right.
And there was also through history a search for objects of power, like the crown of Jesus or relics. And for example, there is a chapelle, La Sainte Chapelle in Paris, is near the Notre Dame. The king of France paid like a crazy amount of money for the crown that was supposed to be worn by Christ during the crucifixion. And the quantity, and then they made a whole cathedral for that, and they were building all these cathedrals to have their relics, because they thought with these objects they could increase their power, and the crusades were actually in many ways the search for these powers, power objects, and even the Nazis were into that, retrieving all these ideas of this grail and the spade of Longines, and it may seem absurd, but through history there had been big efforts to preserve this divine blood and to look for these power objects. But you may
Roxy,
wonder why.
Roxy, listen to this. I began back in 2009 telling us about these powerful artifacts, which became weapons, like the Ark of the Covenant was a weapon you could use against your enemies. So the 20th century people believe that this is superstition, but apparently these objects were incredibly powerful and worth, you know, whole crusades to get a hold of. It was the new technologies. And Ian has gone through with us a lot of these particular artifacts, and we were never allowed to talk about them. They're still valued by the nations or principalities that have them. Ian was careful about how much we talked about it in public, so that's one area we haven't discussed in public is the names of these pretty amazing artifacts. Now, there was a good TV show that came out right at that time called Warehouse 13, which was a CIA warehouse, supposedly, that stored many of these artifacts. So if you go and look at Warehouse 13, they come up with many imaginative variations on the theme of unique objects. So that was fun to watch for a year or so. I didn't keep up with it. I don't even know if it's still going. But that was called Warehouse 13. And that showed up right in time for us. Ion told us to watch it. It just showed up when Ion started. So you could look at it as one of the early Ion productions or JW productions out of Hollywood. And as I said a couple of weeks ago, I think, or maybe even last week, in the opening credits of that show, there's a painting of some scene in Asia or Japan or someplace. And Ion says that painting is a painting of the entrance to the Shangri-La area. So I don't know if the producers knew that, but that was put right there in the opening credits if you go and look at it, which you can go see these shows on primewire.ag. And now, the other thing was, you said that the person had to be very dull. Did you mean the waiter, the assistant who helped the prince had to be unemotional and poised and dull? Or did you mean
no,
the
woman that was feeding the milk to the... No, the...
Right.
I don't know the word in English. In French, it's not this. She had to be, like, always very calm and have a very quiet life. And she was really controlled.
Right.
Just like, she was just there to feed the king. Like, there was no other purpose.
This idea of media ecology. Right. There was the media ecology. That's a phrase that McLuhan and Neil Postman got going in the late 60s. And people think, okay, media, it's a new word, new situation. But you hear from Ion that media ecology was normal human social management all the way through the phases of cultural development. So it was a form of media ecology, people being media, how they arrange the environment around the prince or a princess. That would be very carefully... So humans are always sensitive to the environment, and a lot of it is based on superstition. And we come to, in the Zappa documentary, again, it's striking how Zappa has this put-on weird voice throughout it. They say the problem today is not voting rights, but apathy. And that's because the technologies have changed society, you know, 100 times since 1965. And when you think back of the different phases of culture, America had no voting for 150 years, like say 1700 to 1750, right? They hadn't formed a country. So what were those people doing? I guess they were British. They were in a colony. And they didn't think of themselves as Americans yet. So that goes on for 150 years. It's interesting how our mind glosses over. That's many generations living under very different from...
At the beginning... All the people that went to the colonies at the beginning were slaves. Everybody, also the white people, they made a contract with the company there. And they will then pay their debt, and after maybe, I don't know, 10 years or more, they became free. And at the beginning, some black free people also managed to have some land and establish themselves, but very soon that changed, and they decided, because of these ideas of the race and the blood, not only white males will have the rights to of real citizenship and for example, voting. And Zappa wonder how come we say we're a democracy and you're supposed to have so much property and so much money. And during the monarchies, a title was not enough. It was very expensive to have a title. The people had to pay a lot of taxes mm-hmm. to maintain the title. And they also had to prove that they had not only the blood, but the power. They had to prove they had enough property and men and money to serve the king. Otherwise, these privileges were taken. And for example, McLuhan explains with the, what's the name of the thing you used to sit in a horse? Stirrup?
Yes, stirrup.
Yeah, he said this technology made it possible for the warriors to wear an armor and jump into a horse. But to pay that armor and the swords and the horses was so expensive. Really, they needed like a lot of land and a lot of people just to pay. I think it took like 2 years of
the horse.
Hard work to make this metal clothing to pay the yeah. horses that they will die or get sick and the whole weapons. It was expensive. The whole town had to get together and finance their nobility because it
right.
was
now,
not possible for the nobles or their own to do that.
Yeah, for general knowledge, you know, you could go into who made the first stirrup, how many stirrups failed. You go into details of the actual first use of the stirrup and where it came from. But for purposes of public memory in the world of mortar, it's more convenient just to remember that the stirrup created feudalism and created the houses. Without the stirrup, we wouldn't have principalities, princes and barons and nobles and all the different steps or levels of the upper class. It wasn't until the lands were organized into feudal collectivities, and where the king or the prince would promise to protect people. It was anarchy. It was the Dark Ages just before that. So you would get protected if you joined the commune and helped this one guy have this big weapon, this tank. And remember, that's what McLuhan says, the automobile retrieves the knight in shining armor. The automobile is an early or more recent version of the knight and the effect of the stirrup. So all these houses we're talking about are a recent invention. They only came in, you know, 1,500, 1,300 years ago because society in the Dark Ages probably organized by blood. I mean, we look at Hollywood movies. What's that one with the Scottish guy that everybody talks about? I think I saw it, Blackheart or somebody. They just run around, you know, in gangs, raiding each other. Was there blood, a blood pecking order in those pre-feudal societies? Probably was. Blood organization is the constant, is what you're saying, and what that Belize, Professor Belize, is saying. It's the one constant through all these mutations.
Yes, and even among nobles. Yes, go.
Yeah.
Okay. For among the nobles, there is also like a hierarchy. They consider real nobility these old houses that were really the warriors. They really fought.
Right.
They really went and killed each other. And then the false nobility are the nobles that bought titles or just got married with somebody. But they are not considered as the real aristocracy of the old
right.
houses.
Yeah, you could get somewhere by winning the jousting contest, you know. They show that in the TV series It'll be on again in a few months. I can't even remember right now. What's the one about? Oh, Throne, Game of Thrones. They show, you know, a guy who's going to win the princess. He's got to kill a few other people to get the right to even be considered by the princess. So what you're talking about made me think of this. McLuhan said that the idea that the stirrup feudalism or the printing press brought in the separate churches and private worship and all the things that each technology he documents, he says, for useful social perspective, it is useful to generalize like this. He's not saying in the particulars that, you know, someone might notice the perspective was developed before the printing press. But that's based on normal history. Irons says those dates are all wrong. So we don't know if McLuhan is erroneous in saying, talking about the perspective coming in with the printing press. But remember, he also says effects precede causes. So the artist picks up the effect of the printing press and brings in perspective before there is a printing press. That's a trend he notices. But his point is that over long stretches of information, stretches of time and perspective, the idea of the medium is the message, the most useful practical knowledge for the citizen to understand, so that they would look at the present today and say, well, I brought in this TV to give my kids a, you know, a Christmas present in 1955, give them a TV. They're not thinking of what it's going to do to their family life. But McLuhan's saying a wise citizen would look at that buying of the TV and what it would do to the community. And so that's practical knowledge that McLuhan's offering, not theories, not ideology. Now, Zappa comes in, and he says, I don't know, maybe the late 70s, early 80s in an interview, he says, well, today people are totally hoodwinked by television. They're naive. They don't understand the games that TV is playing on them, the cons. Usually he's talking about content cons, like Republicanism, or no, not Republicanism, the moral majority, how he'll say just before an election, some guy's running for something, so he'll decide that, you know, smoking marijuana is really bad, have a campaign to wipe, you know, arrest all the marijuana smokers to get attention so that he's a name for the upcoming election. So that's content manipulation, and that's use of TV. And McLuhan and Zappa said the people today won't understand TV. They won't be savvy to the games that are being played on them for another 50 or so years. He said the kids in 50 years will understand more. He's projecting 50 years ahead. So the Abby Hoffmans, the Jerry Rubens, and, you know, the Eldridge Cleavers run around demanding revolution, and they have no clue of the dynamics of media spaces and how long those effects take to register and then are irrevocable once the effects come in. Zappa was the only one of public radicalism that had the long view. It's not as sophisticated as McLuhan's, but at the same point, people won't understand TV for another 50, 60 years. And we've come to that point now. It's 50 years later almost. And look, the kids are voting for a communist. They're very aware of the media games, or they think they're aware of what the TV body does, the TV landscape. So Zappa's, his prophecies come true. But it took 50 years. But you couldn't tell that to people who were trying to have their little revolutions in 69 and 70. You couldn't tell that to the feminists. They thought they'd have their revolution pretty quickly. They thought the truth would alter people. But the truth is a tiny soundbite compared to these big media environments. So when they say at the end of this documentary that the real problem today is apathy, that's because the issues that they fought bravely and long, courageously for to get the voting rights are not the issues anymore. You know, most people don't take voting seriously. And it's only the ones who do take it seriously are usually paid or going to get some profit from it, because some guy's going to get in, and if he gets in, they get it, his supporters get jobs. So the last point of apathy is what we're dealing with when we're looking at Zappa. He is looking at the world of apathy that's come in, and he's taking all kinds of different Don Quixote charges at it, including voter registration. So that's an idea about the apathy. That's the important part. And it's partly why Zappa would have a put-on tone. Because what he's talking about... Go ahead.
I just said he even got sick and died.
Yeah, yeah. Over all kinds of who knows what, disillusionments of his own agenda. But remember, he was murdered. So it's not fair to blame Frank for dying. And, you know, I can't prove that.
You cannot be murdered if you don't want to die.
Even if you're murdering suicide.
From Ion's point of view. I forgot about that. Yes, from Ion's perspective, every death is suicide. Frank did set it up so someone else could kill him, so Bob couldn't mock him. But Frank didn't foresee Roxy being here, who remembered the Ion knowledge, and called Frank to the guilt platform. Guilty, Frank, suicidal intention. So, you know, as you got to know Frank, there was sometimes a malaise around him. Even though he went on and didn't stop making great music, he even writes a chapter in his own autobiography saying, you know, how I was a failure. Talks about himself being a failure. Now, maybe that's not too good to talk that way about yourself in the long run. But he may have been disappointed and started off himself. But he was up against a really big, challenging situation. The Android meme was going to bring in the ability for everybody to make any kind of sound through YouTube and that. So he, as a throwback to the 19th century, you know, genius artist who's going to cause, you know, make society better in some way, or even make incredible music. When Ion said, he said last week in the tailgate part, someone asked about Zappa, and he said, well, Zappa just worked with noise. It was only interested in making noise. I don't agree with the statements that Ion makes about Frank. I think he makes lots of non-noise music. But he was, Ion was, said he was frustrated. And you know, the inventor of Mir, Walter Fishman. So he died in 93, right when Carolyn went to New York, but fortunately he had given her the formulas for the herbs and the whole Mir project. So we carried on. But he died on August 12, 1993. And within a year, he started coming back through a medium. And that was how I proved to myself that people survive death, because we made a deal with him to see if he would survive death. And he did. But at one point, I was talking to him, and through the medium, and we said, so did you, like Frank Zappa died just a few months after him. I said, well, did you see Frank? Do you see Frank over there? And he said, yes. He said, and I've never seen anybody come over so angry, so pissed off that he died. So that was always an interesting little thing that I got from, you know, Walter's perspective of watching Frank die. I don't know if that's all subjective. Who knows? The medium could be distorting it, but it's a little bit of information that's in my file. And Ion implied that he was pissed off. So regardless of his emotional state, he goes on to make the greatest music ever made by a human being, and it's far from noise from my perspective. What do you think, Bert? Is it noise? No, it's not noise. Bert's not going to say it's noise. Roxy's not going to say it's noise, so full vote there. Quorum, majority vote. Frank is not making noise.
Types of sound.
Right. He turned noise into, as William Irwin Thompson talked about, jazz turned noise into beauty. Okay, so back to this point. We're looking at, so I'm looking at the 150 years of America before the newspaper comes in. Then the newspaper gets everybody worked up, forming mass emotion of republicanism. And then you go for hundreds of years, 100 years or more, with no vote for the women. And it's interesting when you think about how the printing press emphasizes the left brain and certain logical thinking. The kind of thinking that the printing press and papers and bureaucracy brought in probably wasn't congenial to the feminine mind. The male mind, for some reason, could handle the pain of that kind of new environment. Now, people could say, well, if girls were educated in paper bureaucracy like they did in schools now, or recent schools, then they'd be able to be bureaucrats. But I think that you can say that women are suppressed in that period when the printing press is coming in, and for 200 or 300 years, women, I don't know, levels of them are poor, but there's lots of poor people. Lots of them are abandoned, and it's pretty rugged the way they have to live. But they do find things to do. And it wouldn't occur to them to be, that they were a slave because of their lack of education.
They could not own property, and that was one of the requirements to vote. Even in Greece, where they started these experiments with democracy, with the phonetic alphabet, the individual thinks they have a saying, they have an own opinion. And they think they can somehow say how to program the environment. And this is the vote. You say, I want this person or this type of government, because that's the illusion people have in how the environment is going to be programmed as a monarchy or a communism or wherever they are, they're choosing. But this is really an illusion, because as you know,
well,
things are actually controlled by the foreign groups. they even make
a
1,000 plan for America.
Right. It's not an illusion. That's not the right word. The law is that a new environment and its effects, a new technology, is not noticed by people. It moves too slowly. So it is real what the printing press is going to bring in, but it's not noticed yet. So people are walking into the printing press new environment by looking at the past. So look, the great playwright. What is Shakespeare? What's he write about? He writes about the past. He writes about medieval societies and battles in feudal situations or even pre-feudal. So it's really hard for people not to to live outside of the rearview mirror. So it throws, I say this media knowledge loosens up the overheated brain that is pissed that men suppress women for 1,000 years or 2,000 years. They're missing the media knowledge that shows why people didn't even think in those terms, didn't think they were oppressed in any way that a 1970s woman would think back then. So it deflates the bitterness that people might hold, if they need it, against past actions. And now you come to the present. What are, Gloria Steinem, did you hear about her? Famous, princess of feminism, is hated by the young kids because she said that the young girls today are voting.